Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone, I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast, a weekly show meant to bring you the best in apologetics. And quite frankly, I've got some of that right here today. When I lived in Charlotte, one year my roommate gave me for my birthday a book called 10 Books That Screwed Up the World and 5 Others That Didn't Help. I don't know if somehow he knew I'd been eyeing that at the bookstore somewhat curious or not, but either way, that was when they got me. And I immediately realized I had a classic when I started reading it, and so I got in touch with the author to see if he'd come on the show. And he is indeed on the show, and we're going to be talking about his latest book today called How to Think About God on a Plane. Now, you all are in for a treat today as we welcome Dr. Benjamin Weicker to the show. Dr. Weicker, are you there?
I certainly am, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. Now, my audience might not be as familiar with you as they are some other people, so why should they be taking what you have today seriously?
Well, I have written a lot of books in the area of apologetics. You know, the one that you mentioned, the 10 Books That Screwed Up the World, also 10 Books Every Conservative Must Read. And so I've got a total of, 12 books now. I've taught this is my 14th year teaching full-time and on the college level. I got my PhD from Vanderbilt University way back when. I want to say it's about 30 years ago, which is a little scary. I've been writing and teaching since then, and have not only published books, but I don't know how many articles out there, something like 300 plus. So this latest one, How to Think About God on a Plane, I think is number 12, but there's many more out there, and people can come to the website and see BenjaminWeicker.com.
Okay. Now, what is the whole idea behind this, How to Think About God on a Plane? I mean, why?
Well, I know it's a little strange title, but I got it, and this isn't very surprising at all, while I was sitting in yet another airport terminal, and I'm looking around and watching, I guess, not only what people eat, but what they read, and there's a connection between the two. You know, they're sort of sitting there eating junk food, waiting for the plane, but they're also, you know, they're reading junk. They're reading things that are puffy, that are just meant to pass the time, the kind of thing that really doesn't do much for them. And, you know, then it flashed into my mind, we're here, we're stuck here. And even if you have an hour flight, you really it's a three-hour experience. Could I write something that would be of substance that people could really digest within a regular plane ride, even a short one, so that, you know, it's a shorter book? Can they have something that's got some meat in it, something that's got some depth, so that by the time they're back on the runway when they land, you know, they think differently about things. Something has happened. They've gone deeper, and they believe that they've spent their time well. So that's the goal behind it, and that's the circumstances it arose in my own flying in planes.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, this is a short book that you ought to read. Dr. Weicker sent me a copy, and I emailed him one afternoon and said, well, I'm getting ready to start reading your book. I emailed him a couple of hours later and said, well, I finished reading your book.
You did the right thing. Yeah, it's supposed to happen that way because I don't want people to be, overburdened. You know, I've written big, fat books with lots of footnotes and stuff like that, so, that's one thing. But this, I wanted, you know, the reading things that basically are going to be read in about that same amount of time. Say, okay, why not have them chew on something? You know, go deeply into something, even though you don't have that much time. So about that 2 hour, 3 hour span is about what it should take.
Yeah, but Dr. Wagner, I mean, we have to wonder some about the editorial abilities and such, because don't you know you've got a dangling modifier in your book's title?
Well, I do. I do. Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited because dangling modifiers are one of my favorite creatures in grammar. And in fact, I do start out the book that way. With the old Groucho Marx joke about using a dangling modifier, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. Say, well, okay, what does that mean? I was in my pajamas and I shot an elephant, or I shot an elephant and he was in my pajamas. And, of course, the Groucho Marx joke was, you know, how he got in my pajamas, I'll never know. So the question is, how to think about God on a plane? Is God on the plane, or are we ourselves on a plane thinking about God? And actually, there's... you can go either way. So we can take it, okay, this is not a dangling modifier. We're going to think about God who is actually on the plane. And what would we have to think about God in order for that to happen? Or we can take the other route and say, wait, God is not on the plane. We're just sitting on the plane and we're thinking about God. God is somewhere else, because God isn't the kind of being who can be in a plane. So that's how I start out with those two alternatives. And we can, maybe I'll let you pick. You can go to whichever one you want first.
Well, let's go with the first one. I mean, we can think about God being on a plane. As Christians, we think, you know, God's omnipresent. So, yeah, in some sense, of course, God is on the plane. But then there are other worldviews out there, like Buddhism, for instance, yes. And other pantheistic worldviews. So we're coming at this kind of like from an agnostic position at the start, just saying, how would we think about God on a plane? We might have basic knowledge of all the world's religions. So just take us from where we go. It's time for takeoff.
Okay. All right, well, you know, imagine if you were a pantheist. Now, and pantheism does arise in the West. It's actually very old. It goes back into Greek thought, and it arises in modern thought. So it's not anything either old or new. It's always around. And that's the notion that God is everywhere in everything, literally, quite literally everything. You know, the universe and everything in it is divine. And that makes it clear that not only is God on the plane, since we are all gods, we're all divine, but everything on the plane is divine. And the plane itself is divine. So that's what pantheism brings you to. Now, that's a much different concept, obviously, and it's one with a lot of adherence than what occurs in Judaism, where Judaism makes clear, you know, God is wholly other than creation. So any notion that God is in the plane or everywhere in the sense of physically somewhere is anathema. You can't think that at all.
You go
back again and say... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it before you got to Christianity at the end, that you can finish Judaism, is that those of us who are Christians are listening to this and thinking, but you know, it's absolute nonsense to think that God is actually on a plane, because we know God's not like that. We can look at it and find it ever humorous. I find it amusing what you do with that kind of thinking, but finish what you were saying about Judaism first, please.
Well, Judaism is, you know, brings forth that absolute distinction between creator and creature.
Yeah.
And the weird thing about Christianity is that it accepts that fully. At the same time, it accepts the incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And once you accept the incarnation, then you aren't satisfying either side—the side that simply affirms that God is the plane. God is you and me and everything on the plane. And the side that says, no, God cannot be on a plane. God has nothing to do with being in creation like another physical object. But Christianity with the incarnation introduces a radically strange concept that it could happen that the one instance in which God became a man, he actually did things like ride on donkeys, and he walked along roads, and he sat on tables, and he went into the temple and caused a ruckus. He was physically in a particular place, and that gives Christians a really strange feeling if they think about this. If God had become incarnate now, he really could be on the plane. That is, he really would and could be sitting right next to you in the way that, say, you'd be walking along a road in Jerusalem, and this God incarnate will be walking alongside you. And, you know, it's really easy. I know probably for you and me both, you know, we read the Bible, go, yeah, yeah, I, I believe this stuff, you know, and I, yep. you know, and if I would have been there, I would have caught on right away. No, I don't think so, and unless you can swallow the fact that, say, you know, God incarnate is two seats over from you, you know, and he just got a, you know, a Coca-Cola and a drink or, and, you know, a peanuts or something, and he's sitting there with his seatbelt on. Well, that's, you know, if he were at a meal in Jerusalem, he would be sitting there too, and he would have his plate, and he would have his bread, and so on. So that's the kind of immediacy that the first Christians faced. You know, the apostles are, you know, they had to believe that this man in this particular place with that nose and that hair and those feet wearing those clothes was God. And if we try to think through it ourselves, what would it be like if God were incarnate on our plane? Because it could happen. Now, Christianity shares with Judaism the absolute rejection of the notion of pantheism, that God is everywhere in that, you know, sort of physical sense. He literally is everything in the universe. He's only one man. So Christianity rejects something like pantheism. Also, Buddhism. Buddhism denies any particular being really has existence except God. And so, in that sense, a Buddhist is saying everything is one. The individuality is an illusion. So, in that sense, yeah, we are God. So is the plane. I mean, we're all ultimately one thing, and that is ultimately the one being. And even to have particularity that we're under the illusion that we're particular individuals, but we're not. We're actually not. So, you know, both Judaism rejects that and Christianity rejects that. But you can see why Judaism would look askance at Christianity and say, no, you know, that's the one thing that can't happen. God can't be a human being. And that's why Christianity obviously caused such a scandal right away, is that it's saying something that is entirely new. It doesn't please either pantheists or Buddhists on one side or Judaism on the other side. So we're the only ones that can say, Christians are the only ones that can say that we can think about God on a plane in both ways. We can sit on a plane and think about God, or we can think about what it would be like to have God on the plane sitting next to us.
I've often been told that Genesis 1:1 is the hardest verse in the Bible to believe, and if you can believe that, everything else afterwards is child's play.
Close from and that, yeah. If you really understand what goes with it.
Yeah, but my honest thinking is John 1:14 is the hardest verse in the Bible to believe. Anyone can believe in a God who creates everything, but when you get to the Word became flesh, all of a sudden you're entering very, very new territory.
Yeah, and again, it's kind of easy to read about it in another time.
Yep.
So, you know, so Christians, you know, I can think about a Bible story and those things happening in another time and a place, but if it really happened in front of you, could you believe it? That would be the, you know, you think it would be the reverse. If it happened in front of me, I believe it. Maybe it's not so easy when it is in front of you.
Okay, well, let's suppose we do go the other way, though. We're thinking about God, who, other than, say, omnipresence, it's not on the plane, but we on the plane are thinking about God. Now how do we go?
Well, this is an important thing now because of the time we live in. We live in a time, obviously, where there are planes, but we're also living in a highly secularized age. That is, in a time in which there are many people actively trying to drive thinking about God out, period. You know, whether a plane in the public square, anywhere, don't think about God. God doesn't exist. So, you know, if you're sitting next to a person on a plane that, an atheist or a secularist, they don't think you should think about God at all. So, you know, there is another aspect there. I mean, these people are obviously going to agree that God can't be on the plane, so they're going to agree with Jews, but they don't think God could be anywhere. And what I say in the book is, well, you know, really these kind of people think in a way that planes prove that God doesn't exist. In other words, well, we're sophisticated science people. You know, we're not primitive natives of some, you know, place that pre-scientific and don't understand that, you know, the thunder and lightning actually comes from particular kinds of, you know, physical reactions. We think it comes from, you know, up in the clouds with a sky person up there doing that. We're not that kind of person anymore. We've left that behind. We now can fly planes. We can build planes. And, you know, since we've got this kind of science, then we realize, you know, we can leave God behind. So that's sort of the atheist view. You know, mm-hmm. So he gets on the plane, and for him, the plane itself, in a way, proves the non-existence of God because he believes that science has proven the non-existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a whole other take on it. So now we've got Buddhists, atheists, as well as Christians and Jews on a plane, and all are coming up with different things from that experience and what they think about God.
Yeah, I've liked the part about sitting next to someone and having them be an atheist and looking over and see what you're being and go, psh, like that, which it really resonated with me kind of because I'm the kind of person who'd bring something like this on a plane and be reading it next to someone just to see how, what they say in response. Like, hey, please, feel free to go and debate me on this one.
Yeah. Well, that would be interesting if that happened.
Yes.
You know, that would be interesting if that happened. So, you know, and hopefully I'm providing, you know, people with ammunition even in that, because an atheist, I mean, this is kind of a an interesting twist on it, is it almost, I've never met or know about any other atheist than one who holds that is a kind of materialist, that there's only material, there's only body, there's only, you know, material things in the universe. There are no immaterial things, there are no spirits, there are no angels, there are no human souls. And so the weird thing about somebody like that, and you know, you have to push them on this, because I think maybe their natural inclinations and their way of acting doesn't really support what they say they believe. But if you push them on this, they're going to say, well, am I really that different from a plane? I guess I'm not, because the plane is a material thing, and I'm a material thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and ultimately, ultimately, material things, what we call life in a material thing, according to an atheist materialist, is merely chemical actions and reactions, but that's going on in the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going on in my body, it's going on in the plane. Am I any different than a plane? Am I just another kind of machine? And a little weirdly, I'm a machine that was made by the random actions of, on the molecular level over millions of years. So I'm not even in a way as good a machine as the plane, because the plane was very deliberately and intelligently constructed.
Mm-hmm.
So oddly enough, there's the atheist sitting on the plane thinking, in a way, he's kind of cobbled together by accidents, you know, cosmological accidents over time, whereas he's sitting in a plane, and the plane is very definitely built. I mean, it's obviously intelligently designed, and you want it to be that way, or you wouldn't want to be 10,000 feet in the air.
Yeah.
So he's thinking, well, you know, the difference, but ultimately there's no difference. We're just material things. Oddly enough, the plane is better built than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So you get into this odd situation that an atheist, if he's true to his materialist origins, is actually not going to see a difference between himself and the plane, even though he doesn't act that way. He doesn't act like he's a mechanical thing. He doesn't act like he's a machine. He doesn't talk to a person in the same and then talk to a toaster. You know, he realizes there's a difference between a machine and a living thing. So you don't have that kind of confusion on their everyday level, but if you push them, okay, well, this is what you believe, doesn't it mean that you are no different than a plane? That is, you're just a kind of a complex machine, and the plane itself perhaps is even better built than that. So he said, you know, get a conversation going like that. It might be a good way to do that in a plane.
All right. Well, we're going to get some more information about how to get a conversation started like that in a bit. We're here with Dr. Benjamin Weicker on the Deeper Waters podcast. I'm Nick Peters. We will be back right after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters podcast. We are here with Dr. Benjamin Weicker talking about his book, How to Think About God on a Plane. And if you have a question, you can call in with 714-242-5180. Now, Dr. Weicker, the point, though, it sounds kind of persuasive at first that we're people of science today, and back then people thought all these activities were things from the gods, and today we know better. So why should we go back to these primitive myths when we have this science with us today?
Well, that's a unfortunately a popularized confusion, and in How to Think About God and a Planet, say, you know, really, if you understood the history of science and you understand the history of thought about God, what atheists are often doing is they're comparing primitive thoughts about God with very sophisticated scientific thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, that's comparing apples and oranges. If you go back in the history of science, you know, science itself has a history. Well, go back to primitive science, and they thought dumb stuff. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's how human beings grow up. So they thought dumb stuff too. So you know, you can compare primitive thoughts about God to primitive thoughts about you know, that occurred in science. And I use the example of, okay, well, you know, one of the things is we're up there in a plane, and you can meet with a thunderstorm. And the ancients used to think, you know, gods were throwing thunderbolts and banging on anvils and so on. Okay, well, that's a little silly. Well, let's look at the first scientific attempt to explain what's going on in a thunderstorm. And basically amounts to this, not to be too shocking, but they thought it was something like cloud burps. You know, they didn't have any idea. So there's this notion that, you know, this is basically, you know, the equivalent of somebody burping. And if you look at other primitive areas in, you know, in the sciences, you find the same kind of thing. So we shouldn't compare primitive religion with sophisticated science. We should compare primitive science with primitive religion, and also sophisticated science with sophisticated theology. Now, why is that important? Because there are a whole lot of people, more and more, who are scientists who, the more they look at nature, the more they look at the details of everything from the physics of flight to the origins of the universe, to the incredibly complex parameters that allow life on Earth to exist, the more convinced they are there must be a God, because it all is so wonderfully designed in the most intricate and connected details. So, you know, don't compare, you know, some kind of ancient Greek thought about God with the latest science. Look at the scientists who are now looking at the latest science and saying, you know, this materialism stuff doesn't work. This thought that the universe could create itself doesn't work. This belief that something as complex as human beings who can build planes, who can think about planes and build planes, could have come about merely by a random chemical reaction, that doesn't work. So we're convinced, many scientists are saying, that the more we study nature, the more it leads to God. So, again, don't let an atheist mislead you and, you know, engage in these little, you know, snickering smears and say, no, wait, I'm reading these other books about the latest science, and here are people with, you know, three PhDs saying, wow, I'm convinced ever more thoroughly that God exists because of the depth and complexity of nature. So the notion that science is leading us away from God is really, and I push this in another book as well, Worshiping the State, is really a kind of secularizing myth. It's just not true about the history of science, and it's not true about where science is leading us right now. So actually, I want to say in that sense, our ability to understand the physics of flight has led us actually to a greater affirmation of the complexity of the universe, and hence to what amounts to a greater and greater inference to the fact that God does exist.
You know, back in, I think it was June, and if I'm correct, it was June 8th, I had come on my show, I'm not sure if you've heard of him, but James Hannum, he wrote the book God's Philosophers.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it's all about the rise of science in the Middle Ages, and so when you're talking about the cloud burps, I was saying, you know, that's a bad scientific explanation, but it's also a naturalistic explanation. They weren't sitting around saying, now, how did God do this? And I've seen more and more atheists come up with this idea that we had all these ideas about God doing things, and then we filled in these gaps more and more, and I keep thinking, I think that whole idea is bogus. And well, apparently now you've added another book to my list of books I'm going to have to get someday.
It does. That's why we need to know the history of science.
Yeah.
And the actual status of science now, because if you don't, then you know, an atheist is going to pass this off as if it were actual agreed upon, verified knowledge. Oh yes, science is something that is against religion and displaces it. No, a materialist view of science, a kind of ideological view of science, does, but an open-minded understanding of the complexity of nature does not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also another great source I like to use on this is the Tim O'Neill, I think it's besides Arminium Magnum, where he's an atheist and actually argues against this kind of nonsense out there.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, this kind of stuff we have thinking today, it's incredibly common, because even when I'm discussing the miracles of Christ and such in New Testament history, obviously, where you see, you need a good scientific explanation. And when I'm talking about arguments for God's existence, which I'm sure you like, the arguments I use are the Thomistic arguments, and I get told, well, we need to scientifically test these arguments.
Well, I mean, it depends on what they mean. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, often what somebody means when they say, well, I want to scientifically test something. Well, there are a number of things you can scientifically test, but it's restricted because of what they mean by science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine, and I use this example when I teach classes, say, imagine if I told you that what science meant was only that you could weigh something and tell how much water it displaced. And so that's all that science means. It doesn't mean anything else than that. And you say, okay, well, I'm going to see how much this large basket of fruit or something, what does it weigh, how much water does it displace, and then I'm going to put several volumes of Shakespeare, and I'm going to find out, well, that weighs about the same amount, and it displaces the same amount of water. And then I'm going to put a dog, and okay, well, it does that, and a human being. So I'm putting all these things in there, and what I call science tells me that they're identical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just happen to all displace the same amount of water, and they all weigh the same. And so I say, well, that's what science tells me. You say, well, that's what science is, and it's nothing else than that. Well, in a way, that's what the materialist atheist is doing. You know, that materialist view of science is saying, I'm going to say that the only thing you can know about something is what you can measure in these very particular ways. Okay, well, what do you leave out when you say that? That's the big question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their tendency is to say, well, what I leave out doesn't exist. Well, in a way, that's like saying, well, there's no difference between Shakespeare and a large basket of fruit because they displace the same amount of water and have the same weight. Well, no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the difference is immense between those two. And so if you come up with a kind of materialist view of science, you end up actually blinding yourself to something that is not only right in front of you, but it's part of your everyday experience that you act on. And I provide what I think is the most important example of this in the book. And I use one of the most well-known science we have, you know, still. He's legendary, Francis Crick, the guy that helped, you know, co-discover with Watson the helical structure of the DNA. So he's not a dumb bunny, you know. He's a famous scientist. But he actually wrote a book called The Astonishing Hypothesis, saying that your experience of yourself as a self-conscious unity that can direct his own actions and thoughts and really has thoughts and really acts freely is not true. You're actually entirely determined by the activity in your brain and your body. And it's an illusion that you think you are a self that thinks and acts. Well, this is a kind of self-blinding on the worst level, because Francis Crick couldn't possibly act that way. What would it mean to say, here is my book, The Astonishing Hypothesis? Well, if your astonishing hypothesis is correct, then the book was simply the result of chemical reactions in your brain. It's neither true nor false. That is, the status of it doesn't even make sense. But I'm sure Francis Crick doesn't act like that. He directs his actions. I mean, didn't he have to direct his thoughts to write the book, even if it's a bad book? So here you have an example of somebody coming up with what appears to be a, you know, this profound scientific hypothesis, but it makes impossible the fact that he was a thinking person that came up with a hypothesis. So when you come up with something like that, you say, you know, something went wrong, and we need to look again at what we mean by science, what we mean by knowledge, because if a scientist of such authority can actually utter that in all seriousness, then we need to look again at what we mean by a science. And obviously I'm trying to tell people we don't mean enough. You know, one of the things that has to be in our science is, wow, whatever we are, we can think and act, and we can do it freely, and we have such deep intelligence that we can actually understand how to come up with the physics of flight and build a plane, really, in less than 100 years. It took us to, you know, to go from primitive flight to what we have now. Okay, well, that's part of what we have to explain. You know, it can't just be from a series of chemical reactions, because that doesn't make sense of discovering the properties and the principles of flight. Now, that doesn't make any sense of the very activity of science or the things that we're trying to explain. So, again, you know, sometimes, oddly enough, it's our very brilliance that causes us to make major mistakes in thinking, and this is one of them. And it's rooted in the desire for Francis Crick to make a world in which God can't exist, and he ends up making one in which he can't exist.
Well, I found it interesting about more and more scientists are coming to believe in some sort of God of some sort, because we're often told that if you look at the National Academy of Sciences, the majority of people there are non-theist entirely. So,
yeah.
I mean, is this really the case then?
No, I mean, I'm trying not to say this in a political way, but I can't come up with a good way to do it. But let me say, what if you looked at the National Education Association and you know, so what do people believe in there? Well, you're going to get, you know, a picture of, you know, that would skew things way to the left. It just is the case. In other words, I'm looking at the actual hierarchy of it, not even at all the teachers down there. So that you happen to have people in a particular kind of organization which gathers members in accordance with their basic, you know, accepted beliefs, if they have a predominance of non-believers, then what a shock. You know,
yeah.
I mean, what would you expect to find? And what you actually find when you look at the scientists, the actual practicing scientists, don't just go to some specialized organization. We say, wait a second, now you find over 50% or more are believers. You know, so, and a lot of the ones that actually do believe are afraid to speak up because they're, you know, they're cowed by those who are the, you know, the vociferous atheists. So the notion that scientists are all atheists is false information.
Yeah, it'd be kind of like, for instance, if we went to, when we're having a debate on inerrancy and said, well, we should believe it because most of the people in the Southern Baptist Convention believe in inerrancy. She's like, well, of course they do. You pretty much have to sign on a dotted line there in order to be a part.
That's where you would be, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, that's a skewing of what's actually out there. And this is a long-standing campaign, by the way. People need to be aware of this. And I wrote about this some in another book called The Darwin Myth, but there was actually a secular campaign in the 1900s, I'm sorry, the 1800s, to make sure that people in particular scientific positions had particular beliefs that actually weren't themselves scientific, but the way that they approached scientists. This occurs, you know, quite thoroughly in the movement after Darwinism. That, you know, they say, no, we're going to, you know, you have to hold the line here. We're not going to let you in these prestigious organizations. So there's, you know, there's extra social pressure there to self-define in a particular way that doesn't have anything to do with the science itself. And that has occurred. That has occurred in these scientific organizations, in the same way that it occurs in something again like the NEA that pretends to speak for all educators, but really is a small group who is trying to create the impression that anyone of any substance or merit agrees with them. And what they really mean is, we only let these people in the club.
Yeah, I do have a Darwin myth here, so that's actually one more book that I don't have to add to the collection. But when you're talking about this plan going on about controlling the system and such, I immediately thought of John Dewey and the Humanist Manifesto and the attempt to take over the educational system, which I believe we could say at this point, mission accomplished.
Yeah, I was going to say, I actually wrote about this in another book, in Worshiping the State, because people don't understand how well thought out the secular takeover of higher education was. And it occurred in Europe. It already occurred in the universities in primarily in the 1700s and 1800s. But what occurred in America was that American education was not secularized till about the beginning of the middle of the 1800s, and it occurred because America didn't have any graduate schools. They didn't have any way to grant anyone a PhD. So our candidates went to Europe, and they went to German universities, and the German universities were the peak of the secularist radical enlightenment movement. So what they did was they brought back to American shores all of this secular enlightenment, radical secular enlightenment thinking, and began our graduate programs in the end of the 1800s and the early 1900s. And and of course, what kind of teaching are they going to do? They brought up the secular thought from Europe. What do you think they're going to teach? What kind of people are they going to hire to fill out the graduate programs? Of course, the ones that share their views and come from these universities. So you have this top-down revolution in education, and it occurs in the sciences as well. It occurs in the sciences as well, but it occurs in law, it occurs in literature, it occurs in philosophy, it occurs even and especially in theology and religious studies. So you have an actual a well-defined secular revolution from the top down through education, and it gives the impression that everyone who's anyone thinks this way, when what it really means is we've set up a revolution in the American education system, and that's why we can dominate from the top like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, also in your book, you present a contrast. You've told us some about Francis Crick, but he's not the only Francis worth talking about, is he?
No. Let's talk about Francis Collins, because you've got Francis Crick there. Okay, he's telling us we don't exist, and he doesn't even exist. And anyone who's a scientist rejects the existence of God. But you got Francis Collins. Francis Collins also works with DNA, worked with the very same stuff. And if anything, Francis Collins, who's the head of the Human Genome Project, is way better scientist than Crick ever was. Just way better. I mean, he is a brilliant man. No one can gainsay that, okay? He's also an evangelical Christian, okay? And he was an atheist, or he was at least an agnostic. And there were a lot of things that brought about his conversion. One of them was reading C.S. Lewis, which has had that effect on many people. And then part of it was seeing how people of faith acted when they were facing crisis situations, because he was a medical doctor. And then he also had his own religious experience of the beauty of nature. And that isn't just, oh, wow, look at that sunset. It's, wow, DNA is fantabulous. The human body is marvelous beyond thought. I can't imagine anything other than the greatest, most penetrating, profound intelligence coming up with it. So he calls, DNA the language of God. Well, nobody is going to say that Crick's credentials are better than Francis Collins. You can't put him over. Oh, religion is for dumb people. No. So here you've got the two Francises lined up. You're saying, wait a second. It isn't the fact that science causes us to leave religion behind, because Francis Collins makes the other argument, precisely the opposite argument, that the more he studies DNA, the more he looks at nature in every aspect, the more convinced he is of the existence of God. So here, you know, this we need this kind of thing to shake us up. And the more people like Collins come out, the more other people are less, let's say it this way, they're more courageous about saying, yeah, I believe in God. I have the same reaction when I look at all this stuff. And so science doesn't lead away from God. And being a scientist doesn't mean joining the atheist club.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break at that, and be back to talk a little bit more about Francis Collins after this break. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our guest is Dr. Benjamin Weicker, and we'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
We're on the air of Dr. Benjamin Weicker. Our call number is 714-242-5180. And when you were talking about Francis Collins, I was thinking about Sam Harris and his book, The Moral Landscape. He's kind of very essentially at what Michael Ruse calls a 15-page rant about Francis Collins. And how he even says at one point, says, do we really want someone who believes in a resurrection from the dead to be in charge of a human genome project? And I'm thinking, well, if he's the most qualified scientist in his field and the most academically tested one, he's capable of doing the job, yeah, you bet I do.
Well, I sure don't want Sam Harris in charge of it.
Yeah.
I mean, that should go without saying. I mean, that's just a... I mean, I'm not to be too nasty, but Sam Harris is not a first-rate thinker. Mm-hmm. He's one of the ranters, and I don't mean he's dumb or anything like that. But you know, he's some of these guys get where they are by wisecracks,
mm-hmm.
and that's where I put him. He's just not a profound atheist, and a sign of it is that kind of behavior. I mean, why go on a 15-page rant? You know, why not be a man and say, this is really weird. I can't explain this. How could somebody who's obviously this intelligent, who is the best person to do this, and he did it. You know, he actually achieved it. They mapped the genome. What do you want, Sam Harris? What is the other sign of success that we aren't seeing here, that believing in the resurrection is getting in the way?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this shows a kind of irrationality, almost a childishness. Mm-hmm. Rather than manning up and saying, you know, this is at least, you know, this goes against what I believe about atheism and about what the science should lead us to, and so I've got to explain it, you know, and I've got to come up with another explanation for why this man believes this way, and maybe I got to be brave enough to look at my own beliefs, mm-hmm. but he didn't do that. He's going to rant. Yeah, I can sell books and I look clever.
Yeah. Well, we could sit back here and mention this Francis and that Francis and this scientist and that scientist. And like you said, Brooke, we could just pile up the numbers on and on. But eventually, what we have to do is just look at the arguments themselves. So let's go back to Crick here, Ben. Crick's argument is apparently the only thing that exists is the plane.
Yeah.
So how do we get to that conclusion, and what's wrong with it?
Well, you know, the strange thing is that when he wants to reduce everything to mere chemical activity, it leads him to deny the fact that, again, he's a self-conscious living unity. And I put all those things in there that are important. He's not really a unity because, these chemicals are just going, they're acting just like chemicals would anywhere else. They happen to be built, you know, somehow accidentally constructed into what he is. But his actual experience of forming words and typing and controlling his own actions, Francis Collins has to deny. That means Francis Collins has to deny not only what he does, but that he is. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, he's reducing himself to a plane. That is, a plane really doesn't have any, it doesn't experience itself as a self-conscious choosing unity. You know, it doesn't have that. It doesn't write books. It doesn't think about Francis Crick, you know, even though Francis Crick can think about a plane. So weirdly enough, Francis Crick himself doesn't exist, but he doesn't have any wish to deny the plane. So you don't have any Francis Crick anymore. It's not only that you don't want to think about God on a plane, it's that you don't really think anyway, because Crick reduces thinking to mere chemical activity, which is determined by the nature of the chemicals. So it's not really even thinking. I mean, he just says this in his book. You're thinking, how could you say that? Didn't you have to think of this paragraph, however poorly reasoned it is? Do you really want to say that this was caused by chemical reactions? So what you have then is Crick denying, again, that he's even as good as the plane, because ultimately the plane was designed. I mean, he has to admit that, or it wouldn't fly. And he's ultimately going to say, well, I myself don't even design my own thoughts, and I myself am not the product of design, but of random chemical reactions. So this is the length that someone like Francis Crick has to go to deny God, because that's really what's at the source of it. He wants to deny that there's a soul. That's it. He wants to deny there's a soul. Because if you allow there's a soul, well, then why not God? You know, if I've got a spiritual aspect to me, why can't another spiritual being exist? Well, that would unravel his whole atheist worldview. So he's stuck. In order to make sure that God doesn't exist, Crick has to show that he doesn't exist. And that means, again, that he can't think about God on a plane, that he isn't even a he. Francis Crick isn't even a person, an I who can think, and that the plane itself is really the only thing that's designed, not the human being. And once you get yourself into that kind of absurdity, you think, any truly rational person who has not lost his sanity, and sanity means being connected to what's real. He's disconnected from what's real. He doesn't act that way. I mean, what would it look like to try to act like you weren't a being who could choose his own actions? I don't know what it would be. Yeah. So here you have somebody utterly undermining everything around him for the sake of not allowing God to exist, and that should be, for him, a sign that something went wrong. A sign he's got to rethink the whole thing.
I found it interesting. He said he has to deny this. I immediately thought of one of my favorite quotes of Chesterton I've been using even today, where he says that when it comes to, for instance, miracles, the theist believes in a miracle, rightly or wrongly, because of the evidence for or against it. The atheist disbelieves in a miracle, rightly or wrongly, because he has a dogma against them.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it's an interesting thing that you should bring that up, because it does bring the atheist into a kind of denial of what's right in front of his eyes, what he experiences in himself. And there's we've ever read Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion.
The God Delusion.
But he actually sets out in the beginning of that book that it would be, if you walked into a Catholic church and you saw a Virgin Mary statue wave at you, that would be a matter of the chance movement of the molecules. It's extraordinarily improbable, but it could happen. So that if Richard Dawkins actually did see this happen, he thinks he would say that. On that same grounds, you could say from the random action of molecules, a dead person could suddenly come alive. It just happened that, since he's merely a chemical thing, that really deadness and livingness don't really mean anything as categories. Nothing is essentially different except the connections of the matter. And so it could happen that all the chemicals would suddenly, like the waving Virgin Mary statue, you could have the chemicals revive themselves. So if you saw somebody raised from the dead, you could say, wow, that was lucky. Or here's a leper coming in and, somebody touches him and all of a sudden his arm is healed. And you say, well, that was lucky. I guess that was the random action of the molecules. Really improbable, but we can't think of any other explanation for it. So you get that kind of, wait, you're losing your mind, for your theory. You're losing your mind for your theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what we keep seeing more and more of is that these people who claim to live by the evidence over and over it, what I keep giving them is, I live with the evidence as long as I can fit that evidence into my worldview. As soon as you present anything contrary, well, that doesn't fit. We'll find a way to do it. It becomes a naturalism of the gaps.
I like that. That's true. You say, well, even though this appears not to fit in at all, we know beforehand that anything that doesn't fit in can't exist.
Mm-hmm.
You say, well, wait a second. Aren't you assuming what you're supposed to be proving? it used to be elementary logic. We were taught you can't assume what you have to prove. You can't assume materialism and then have all these gaps that if they were filled would actually prove materialism. You can't do that. You actually have to demonstrate that your argument about things is correct, and that means you can't just ignore evidence, especially evidence that simply undermines your everyday experience in the activity, especially the activity of a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, don't scientists think? Don't they act as self-conscious living unities who discover things by using their mind, which they seem to be able to direct to do things, to look at certain things and to think about them? Well, if that's the case, then it can't be the result of a series of chemical reactions, because then their science wouldn't either be true or false. But if that were true, they wouldn't discover things. How could they ever discover things? If they couldn't get it right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So science itself, on this ground, actually proves the existence of, I would argue, the immaterial soul.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I think you can argue that is, well, look what happens when you do Crick's thing, where you deny the soul and you simply affirm that it's all chemical activity. You kill thinking. You make thinking impossible. But I thought we were thinking when we were scientists. I thought that was the whole point. If we look at the actual activity of science, and we have to say, there's something more going on here than Crick is telling us, and there's something wrong with that approach. Otherwise, we should be able to explain science. If you have a science in which you can't explain science, if you have a science in which the scientist disappears, we got to start over again. Something went wrong.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've got in the book, it's an argument to demonstrate that you do have a mind and you can react to things. And I'm going to try and give a variant of it, or help you give a variant of it. But for anyone listening, before this happens, I want you to be paying close attention. Please turn up your radio, your volume, for a little bit. Now, according to Dr. Weicker, anyone who did that just proved his point. And you saw that immediately, I can tell. So how did how did telling them to turn up their radio prove that they can think?
Well, notice, and it even proves more than that. We're going to say that it proves they have an immaterial soul. So we're going to go. We're just going to just put our cards on the table.
Okay, let's go.
There you go. Let's do that. Because if you were a mere set of chemical reactions, and that everything that had, that occurred all around us had to be the result of literal physical actions and reactions.
Mm-hmm.
Think why it wouldn't make sense for you to be able to freely choose, to listen to my words, which didn't come out like big blocks and hit you. You listened to my words, you understood the words, actually listened to your words, they understood your words, okay? And the words themselves are not physical; they're intellectual concepts. They're not like a block of ice or a piece of wood. They're intellectual concepts. They aren't simply electrons, zipping through your head in particular angles. So you're able to take what amounts to an immaterial cause. I'm telling you to do something with an immaterial concept. And then using your body, using your brain, okay, you're able to direct your brain and hence your hand to turn up the radio knob, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you were a pure material being, which was just a bunch of chemical reactions, that would be inexplicable.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want people to do is think about this. This is like Francis Crick, let's tie you down. When you do this, what's really happening. Don't tell me what your Astonishing Hypothesis book says. We already got that. What are you experiencing? You actually freely did that. You chose to do it. You understood it. You thought about it. And you did it. So you're a thinking being. You're a freely acting being. And you're not reducible to the chemical structures. Yes, you have those chemical structures. Yes, you have an arm. You know, you just didn't think, turn radio. It doesn't work that way. We use our arms. We use our brains. But we are the ones using them. So there's this immaterial aspect using the physical aspect. And that's true. We know from neuroscience now that actually thinking about things creates pathways of the neurons in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't there before. You thought about it. It creates that in the same way that we think about, I want to turn that radio up, and you can. You use your arm. So we're not trying to say that we're ghosts or that we are, you know, we can do something just with our intellects. But our intellects can use our body, and that's a sign that we aren't reducible to our bodies and our minds aren't reducible to our brains.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, you get from all of this, in fact, we've only got a few minutes left in this segment, so we might have to give just a strawberry argument, but you can say, we can get from this to show that the plane demonstrates that God exists.
Yes. And yeah, I guess we do. I can see we have to stretch this one out. But I just want to get people to think about this, say, well, what is a plane made of? Okay, what is it made of? Well, okay, it's got a lot of, you know, it's metal in it, there's glass, there's plastic, and, you know, there's various things. You say, well, those things have their own chemical structures and so forth, you know, whatever you're looking at. You have all the wires, and you can break those down into their chemical components and so on. But I want to say something a little different about that. Yeah, it's true, the plane is made of material. But it's actually made of ideas and material. And the ideas aren't physical. The ideas are the things that formed those parts of the plane into particular shapes in regard to the larger structure of the plane. And those ideas themselves aren't the plane. They're the thing by which the plane was made. They're the thing which gave the plane its form. So it's actually made of immaterial ideas and matter, and that's what makes it fly through the air. It's actually literally not glue or screws or welding that holds the plane together. It's the ideas. So that's probably where we want to pick up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and we'll take an early break, and then we'll come back and we'll finish looking at how the existence of a plane proves the existence of God. Be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com. Home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our guest today is Dr. Benjamin Weicker, talking about his book, How to Think About God on a Plane. He'll only be here for about 15 more minutes, and the rest of the time you have to put up with just me, so I'm sorry about that for your suffering. But next week, we've got a special guest here. Back in June, I interviewed John Walton, author of The Lost World of Genesis 1, a fascinating interview, one I point back to several times, where he co-wrote a book with Brent Sandy called The Lost World of Scripture, and I've been reading an advanced copy, a really amazing look at the world of Jesus and the New Testament and the Old Testament. John Walton's not going to be here, but Brent Sandy will be here next week to talk about his book that he wrote with John Walton, The Lost World of Scripture. You all really need to be here and see this one. I mean, this was one book that I read just a couple chapters of immediately. I was telling people, you got to get this book when it comes out. You just have to get it when it comes out. But we're back with Benjamin Weicker. The call number is 714-242-5180 if you want to ask a question. But they're talking about how a plane shows God exists. And we've been saying a plane is made up not just of matter, but ideas that are used to put that matter together the correct way. So how do we get from there to God?
Well, we need to think about that. I mean, that's we take the thing for granted. But if you really looked at the intricacy of a plane, you would see how much thought went into it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say the idea is that when the plane is made of matter is an idea, what you really mean are human beings thought and worried and pried apart the world, tried to figure it out with this notion that we want to fly in the air. And all of that is really in the plane. That is, that's what gives it the form that it has. It isn't that the parts just, you know, came that way. Those parts were made very, very specifically by the ideas that formed our understanding of how we can fly. And that goes in the history of chemistry, you know, from the fuel to the way to create certain, you know, light materials and metal alloys and so on. You can go all the way down the line. So, and this was done over a period of about 100 years. And it's an enormous achievement. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, stand back on that look and think about, say, another explanation of human intelligence, say, from a Darwinian view. That is, from a view that evolution occurred, but it has no divine guide. And so the capacities that anything has, or whatever makes it up, are the result of natural selection related to something that is actually going to benefit the survival of that creature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, look again at the plane and look at modern science, you know, the physics and chemistry and so on that made that. The capacity, the intellectual capacity to do that is so far beyond what could ever have been produced by mere natural selection, just by what would have aided our survival, that
mm-hmm.
it doesn't make any sense at all. You know, another, I use the analogy, if a cheetah can go 60 miles an hour, and that's faster than a gazelle, you say, okay, I get that. But what if cheetahs went 600,000 miles an hour? Wouldn't you wonder about the explanation that the speed itself was the result of natural selection? Because why would it have, it wouldn't have created mm-hmm. something that would go that far, because it only ever goes a little above, you know, in random variations what's needed. You don't have a mutation that suddenly makes things jump by a factor of 1,000. It just
mm-hmm.
doesn't happen. And so here you've got human intelligence capable of understanding the physics of flight, the chemistry that goes into it, and so on all the way down the line, and can actually make this thing. And so you have to wonder about the mind itself. How could it be that something so extraordinary could ever have been produced simply by a random mutation in natural selection?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't make sense on an explanation.
Now, in
and so
all of this,
well, there must
also,
be a divine. I'm sorry, what?
In all of this, also, when we're saying this, we're not arguing for truth or falsehood of evolutionary theory. I mean, for the sake of argument, we could even grant evolutionary theory for your position, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't, and that doesn't bother me, because I think you can have a theist account of it, and I reject the Darwinian atheist account. But
yeah,
you could stand back from the whole thing and say, I'm going to take your terms. Could it possibly explain it? You say, where else in nature do you find anything that so far surpasses what could actually help the actual conditions of its survival, when you say it should have arisen? Doesn't make sense. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Your explanation doesn't make sense. Whatever happened, that couldn't have been that. Okay? Because you don't find anything else like that in nature. And look at the human body. You know, if you're, say your arm were as powerful as your mind beyond what it took to get you to survive in the wild, you'd be able to, you know, to juggle Mack trucks. You know, think how powerful the human mind is. You know,
yeah.
It wouldn't make sense. You know, why would I get so strong? Is there anything else in nature that's that strong, that's this small? No. Okay, so just you take the human mind out, the human body is not really that astounding in the sense of what it's capable of doing. But the human mind is absolutely extraordinary. Okay, so you have to stand back and say, whatever happened, this account of evolution, which obviously has an atheist intention, is insufficient to explain how it is we could have the kind of mind that could build a plane. And since you're reading this book on the plane, you have to, there is a plane. Planes exist. And so can you infer from that that God exists? Well, if what the capacity that we have really amounts to an immaterial capacity going far beyond the material conditions that could have produced it, why can't there be another being who is a spiritual intellectual creature who is actually capable of creating the universe in such a way that something like the mind can develop by divine guidance? If the plane can develop by human intelligence, why can't human intelligence, which is way more complicated than a plane? And so we have to explain not only the existence of a plane now, but the existence of human intelligence. Why couldn't there be that being? Because the attempt to explain away that kind of a being led me to, really a situation in which I can't explain the plane. So again, we're being driven to the conclusion that there's something way more to human beings than this materialist atheist position allows, and so that way more leads us to say, why can't there be God? And it certainly looks like there is a God.
So, with this kind of argument going on, then the hopes is that when someone gets off a plane, if they got on, they were an atheist, they would at least by this point be an agnostic and say, well, maybe there could be something out there.
Well, maybe, look, how about a little doubt for a change?
Yeah.
Okay, atheists say, well, I'm skeptical. That's why I come up with this atheist position. I'm skeptical. Okay, why don't you be skeptical of your atheism? Because now you have good reason to.
Yeah.
You went on the plane confident that God didn't exist, and in a short time say, some of the air has been let out of the balloon. Why don't you turn that rationality, say you're rational, turn it on your own position. Be fair. Okay, you can turn it against believers. You can you can be skeptical of belief. Why don't you be skeptical of your own unbelief?
Yeah.
Be fair. That's what reason should do, right? I mean, isn't it supposed to inquire into all the possible positions? Well, let's be brave. So, yeah, I would hope that this book isn't just for believers. I mean, certainly believers can. It's not even a Christian-based book. It's sort of like more like a natural theology approach.
Yeah, because when you end the book, it could be Judaism, it could be Islam, it could be Christianity, could be some form of deism. We don't know. All we know is there's something out there.
And the sign of that is, hopefully you landed and you're safe. In other words, planes work. And that's the whole, reason I wanted to end that was that, think about the actual plane. But people have to think about it.
Yeah.
In other words, if you don't go through the process of actually doing the thing and thinking about it, like you were tricking your listeners into, hey, turn your radio up.
Yeah.
And in the book, I use the example, turn the little nozzle that puts the semi-fresh air blowing on you.
Yeah.
Say, well, think about what you did.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really want to deny that you freely chose that action and that you can think?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm hoping that people, that it's a kind of book where you can kind of, you're reading a little, and in between the time when they're bothering you about drinks and so on, you can think about what you're doing and think about the plane so that the actual experience of it does bring you to God if you're brave enough to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, folks, this book, it's also got another great benefit. A lot of you are going to like it. It doesn't cost a lot. Like on Amazon right now, you can get the paperback for about $5, and that's even with Amazon Prime, and you can get delivered to your Kindle for $1. There's not much better uses of $1 today than to get a great book by Benjamin Weicker.
I mean, this is almost less than Starbucks. You can get a paperback copy in your hand, and my gosh, it's less than a pack of lifesavers today to get it on your Kindle for $99. And that's a sign is that I'm obviously not intending to get rich from this.
It's not how to think
about God in a plane, so I can buy my own private jet.
This book costs less than the drinks and chips you're going to buy on the plane.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. And what would be really nice, if this happened to me, I'd be so tickled, I don't know what I would do. I would probably just laugh out loud and make a fool of myself on the plane. But, you know, if people could buy the thing and read it on the plane, instead of taking it with them, tuck it in the little pocket.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because people get bored on planes, too. They're so bored they're reading those awful magazines.
Yeah.
You know? So they can, you know, I think it's small enough so that it fits right in there. And, you know, somebody else might discover it. So it would be sort of like mm-hmm. I don't know what, you know, as Richard Dawkins would say, a meme. Mm-hmm. So, you know, something that could be on there. So I'm thinking, you know, especially since it's not, you know, it's open. It's about God. It isn't about Christianity as such. Well, it says things about Christianity. That it'll have that wider audience. And then, yeah, people can think more carefully about these things. And if you buy the book, the physical book, you know, leave one there. See what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Dr. Wacker, you're only here for about 4 or 5 more minutes. How can my listeners find out more about you?
Well, you can come to my website, again, www.benjaminwiker.com, and that's W-I-K-E-R. I get spelled all kinds of ways, but it's very simple. It's just like biker, hiker, but with a W. So it's benjaminwiker.com. And on there I have all of the books. I mean, that is, you'll be getting them through Amazon. And so I've got books for everything from, you know, Answering the New Atheism, which is related to Richard Dawkins, to actually the book, one of my most popular books, is a book about the history of chemistry, which is fascinating, written for young people. I mean, young, like, you know, to 14 through 16 or 17. There's things, even things like that. And as I mentioned, there's 10 books that screwed up the world, 10 books every conservative must read. And even a big, thick academic one called Politicizing the Bible, which is about the history of scriptural scholarship and what went wrong and how it is that, oddly enough, in so many places where they're teaching about the Bible, they're actually teaching about it in such a way that it completely undermines belief. And that's a long story. As I say, it's a thick book. So I've got things on that website, including links to a lot of articles that I've written all over the place. So there's probably about as much information there, along with the books, as you can get anywhere else.
Yeah, folks, I can tell you that I read a whole lot of books on apologetics, and sadly, many of them are very, very dry. Dr. Wacker's books are never dry. There is always good stuff in them.
Oh, well, I appreciate that.
Now, is there any final message you'd like to leave for my audience?
Well, you know, always bring down God's blessing on them for giving us their time today. So we appreciate that, and of course, appreciate yours. Come by and look at the website and see what might attract you. Because I'm trying to write, I hope, and you say, a lively way. I don't want to put people to sleep. I want them to be enlivened and learn something that actually changes their lives and makes them a better person. So. If I can do that, then I haven't lived in vain, I guess.
Well, Dr. Wacker, I certainly hope you've enjoyed your time on here. It sure sounds like you did.
Absolutely.
And you're always welcome to come back here, so whenever you get another book out or if you want to discuss an old book, let me know, and we'll get you right in here.
I certainly appreciate it, and thanks so much for having me on.
No problem. Thank you for coming.
And
I really do encourage all of you out there to go and get Dr. Wacker's books. They're some of the best that you're going to read on these topics. But you've now got me here for about 46 minutes or so. And I'm going to be talking about something else for the time being, something that's come up to my attention recently. This is something that I posted on my Facebook, so if you're friends with me on Facebook, you've already seen this. If not, you should really consider adding me. Now, I'm going to quote an organization here. I'm not going to tell you what I'm getting a quote from, but this is what it says. It says, this group estimates that there are more than 19.7 million new STIs in the United States each year. While most of these STIs, and by that I mean sexually transmitted infections, will not cause harm, some have a potential to cause serious health problems, especially if not diagnosed and treated early. Young people, ages 15 to 24 are particularly affected, accounting for half, 50%, of all new STIs, although they represent just 25% of the sexually experienced population. Okay, now some of you out there listening and thinking, well, there you go. You're quoting from some Christian website, and they've got a huge bias in this field, and of course they want to paint the worst picture possible. No. That comes from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. Did I get there from a Christian website? No. I looked up Center of Disease Control there online, clicked references to sexually transmitted diseases, having heard about this claim several times, and looked at it myself. What I read from you is a cut and paste from the end of the article. It tells us that 25% of the population, ages 15 to 24, have 50% of these diseases. And in fact, when they get these diseases, some of them will be much more serious, and they won't be detected for years, which could mean they could be spreading these diseases to other people, and it's going to affect their health later on. It could affect, for instance, the ability of a woman later on in her life to give birth if she has one of these diseases. And I'm looking at this also thing, age 15. I'm not sure what many of you were doing, but age 15, I wasn't making out with a girl, sorry. In fact, I was probably doing something most of you weren't doing. I was preparing to have back surgery, which I had 2 months before I turned 16. But at any rate, I wasn't getting out of the house on my own and doing those kinds of things with women. And if you grew up in the generation before mine, chances are it was far less likely. Unfortunately, many in my own generation, though, were doing this kind of thing. I remember being in high school and hearing after the night of prom that the topic that people would be discussing back and forth is, what hotel did you go to on prom night? It's treated so casually, and I was just listening to this just aghast, because I grew up in a good Christian culture. I didn't know apologetics then, unfortunately. I mean, my home was Christian. I was raised Christian. I have that all around me, and I had known this is something that's only for marriage, and here's all these kids out here going out and playing around really before they can know any better. And I find this incredibly concerning, especially if they're being so promiscuous and having multiple partners, how many more people are going to catch diseases? Now, the CDC recommends that you get checked regularly for these kinds of things, especially if you're active and you're having multiple partners, to which I was thinking, when I got married, I didn't get checked. My wife didn't get checked. Could it be because we both waited until we were married and we don't have anything that we have to be afraid of? Now, I'm not talking about getting like a regular gynecological exam. Every woman should do that, I think, before marriage. I'm talking about getting checked for diseases. We did not have to check for STDs because we did not do anything that would have given us STDs. Now, that I quoted was from the Centers of Disease Control. Now, I'm going to quote part of this here at this point. When we come back, I'm going to try and read the whole thing here. But this is another organization. This is what they've said. Since the number of sexual partners you've had doesn't say anything about your character, your morals, or your personality, or about anything at all, really, there's nothing bad or unhealthy about having a big number of sexual partners. Now, who did this claim come from? It came from someone representing another organization. And if your guess for that organization was Planned Parenthood, go to the head of the class, because that is exactly what Planned Parenthood said. Now, I've got some ideas about that kind of thinking as well, but we're going to get to that after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcasts, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I really would like to encourage you all to donate. And Via Projects Ministry, it's tough, and we don't get a lot out there that so many other ministries get. I've told people several times that when people like myself or Mike Lacona or N.T. Wright or anyone else with an apologetics ministry is out there doing well, and meanwhile Joyce Meyer and Joel Osteen are out there begging for donations, that would be a good day for Christianity. We're on the front lines taking the bullets regularly, and I'd like you all to really consider donating to Deeper Waters, especially with the end of the year coming up and making those final tax deductible gifts. And one of the best ways you can also donate to Deeper Waters is through Ratio Christi. Just look for me with the Ratio Christi Issues and Answers section. You can be a donor, and getting a one-time gift is great, but if you're going to be one of those people who'd be willing to be a monthly sponsor, you would be doing so much for us here. So honestly, we struggle to make ends meet around here, and what helps us most is your donations. It helps keep this show going, keeps my blog going, keeps every aspect of ministry that I do going. And if you want that to keep going, if you want to say, hey, I like what you're doing here, I support it, I want to celebrate it, then please, make a donation. Now, here's what's going on here. At a Planned Parenthood, a teenager asks the question, and keep in mind, Planned Parenthood is the largest provider of abortion. And they celebrated a birthday recently, which immediately led to an outcry on Twitter of how many children don't get to celebrate a birthday because of Planned Parenthood. Here's what someone asked. They asked, is promiscuity a bad thing? And the answer from the Tumblr account came, since the number of sexual partners you've had doesn't say anything about your character, your morals, or your personality, or about anything at all, really, there's nothing bad or unhealthy about having a big number of sexual partners. What? It doesn't say anything about you whatsoever? You know, regardless of whether it's unhealthy or not, I think it does say something about you. Every single thing that you do says something about you. The fact that you are listening to this show says something about you. Now you could be saying, I'm a Christian. Okay, maybe even you're listening because you want to build up your faith system. You want to understand what you believe better. That says something about you. Or it could be the case, well, I'm an atheist. Okay, maybe you want to hear what someone on the other side says. Maybe you want to get an argument going with me. You know what? That also says something about you. What you go and get to eat says something about you. What books you read says something about you. What TV shows and movies you watch says something about you. Your exercise habits, your writing style, everything says something about you. Why not your behavior? Of course, what we could say is that, you know, if there's really nothing good or evil even about sexual partners and how you do things, and just as well say, well, there's no basis as well for any moral status whatsoever. I can just as well condemn homosexual behavior, and you can't really say anything. It really doesn't say anything about me. I mean, it's just about sex, after all. It's no big deal whatsoever. But yeah, it does say something. And it says something, for instance, if you're a spouse who is sexually faithful to your other spouse, that says something about you. It also says something about what you think about your spouse. The reason I make it a point to try my hardest to not look at other women, it says something about me, yes, but it also says something about what I think about Allie. You know, it could be, for the sake of argument, what I think about her is wrong. It's not, but it could be. You know, it sure says something about what I think, and the fact that she wants to avoid temptation and that she wants to be faithful to me, it says something about what she thinks about me. She could be wrong. I hope she's not. But it says something about what she thinks about me. So, now, here was the full response. Unfortunately, some promiscuous women are judged in a negative way by society, but promiscuous men are more accepted in society, which is totally unfair. Now, I do agree with that part. I think we should be consistent. When we talk about men who sleep around so much and celebrate them as being real men, you know, the men who go out and score with all the women, and meanwhile we look at women who sleep around and say they're sluts, I think we are being inconsistent. I think we should either say either both of them are doing something that is wrong, or we should say both of them are doing something that doesn't matter. I think if we take a look at our society and see where rampant sexual behavior has gotten us, we can see which one of those is more likely, especially when we contrast it with the CDC article, which explicitly shows that this kind of behavior is, in fact, unhealthy, especially the more that you do this kind of thing, it's going to lead to trouble for you. So, going back. Why do I keep putting promiscuous in quotes, which this writer does? Because there's no standard definition of what it means. Some people think that a person is promiscuous if he or she is involved with multiple sexual partners at the same time. Other people think a person is promiscuous if they have a certain number of partners over the course of a few years or longer. And with some people, promiscuity doesn't necessarily mean having sex. To them, a person who goes on a lot of dates or makes out with a lot of people might be promiscuous too. Okay, now if I was to define promiscuous, it'd be very simple. It'd be if you're having sex outside of marriage, you're being promiscuous. You could be highly promiscuous or lightly promiscuous. There are degrees of it, but in either case, you're being promiscuous. I think if you're dating women just to use them, even if you're not sleeping with them, that could be counted as promiscuity. And if you're dating someone of the opposite sex while you're married, that's also counting as promiscuity, whether or not you're sleeping with them. Okay. So promiscuity is a word that can refer to a whole variety of different sexual behaviors. But in general, it's a word that's used to judge or shame people. And again, it's a term that's most often directed at women. Well, it can be used to judge or shame, but it can also be used to describe a moral behavior that's taking place. And moral behaviors should be judged. We judge every moral behavior. We judge whether we want it to be something that you should do or shouldn't do. And even some behaviors that could be considered non-moral, we can judge. There are some activities that might seem perfectly innocent, but when done at the wrong time, could be considered problematic. If you're part of a marching band, that's a fine time to clang cymbals. If you're in a church service and everyone's praying, that's a terrible time to clang those cymbals together. And meanwhile, my own spouse, being, since we're both on the spectrum of Asperger's, one of the characteristics she has is she can be scared easily by a loud noise. If you're around her and you know this and you clang those cymbals, well, that's just wrong. Now, it could be you do it when you're around her and you don't know that and you realize what was done, and I don't think you're really guilty of anything. You should apologize, but you're not really guilty because you didn't know. But if you do know later on, then it is a problem. But for Planned Parenthood, they're not really looking at the behavior itself as a problem. They're looking at these effects not on people's physical health, which is what we should really be considering, but on how these people will end up feeling about themselves. Now look, we're all going to get judged and shamed by people. I get judged and shamed by atheists constantly because of my beliefs. They're seen as ridiculous, seen as silly, prima facie, right at the start. You know what? That's okay. I can take it. I'm not saying I enjoy it. Sometimes I actually do enjoy it, because sometimes I think some of these atheists really expose their lack of clear thinking on certain issues when they speak out. So I really don't have a problem there. But part of this that I see going on is it is so easy to hold people hostage with your feelings. I mean, earlier when the Chick-fil-A Day was going on, I wrote a blog post responding to Rachel Harold Evans, and I called it The Tyranny of Whiners. And I wrote it because Rachel Harold Evans writes about these people going to Chick-fil-A. Now, while people are going to Chick-fil-A, they're not really making a statement about homosexuals. Some are. I don't doubt it. Some are making a statement about homosexuality. I don't doubt that either. You know what most of them are really making a statement about? They're making a statement about marriage. They're saying they support marriage as between one man and one woman. And what they're saying is, we support Chick-fil-A for its stance. And this was after people were treating Chick-fil-A negatively, such as in Chicago, with the idea being raised that they weren't even going to let Chick-fil-A open a store there. You know, all of a sudden, that free speech didn't really matter as much. Now, Rachel Harold Evans has several friends who are homosexual, apparently, and they talk about how they feel so persecuted on this day. They suffer so much on this day, and she's just begging Christians, please, please don't go there. I'm sorry, but we're not responsible for that. We do get to celebrate and uphold marriage if we want to. And because these people feel a certain way, we're not responsible for their feelings. Now, if we were going out there and intentionally saying something to them, that would be different. But we're not. We're saying what we're saying. And if it's true, it's true. If it's false, it's false. But how a person feels depends on what's going on with them, what they're trying to tell themselves, what they're teaching themselves. You can't make anyone feel anything. I can demonstrate this very, very easily, okay? I like you all to think about a time when you're depressed. Or maybe you're depressed right now, okay? Well, here's what I want you to do right now. Feel happy. Now, some of you are sitting there thinking, well, that'd be great. I'd like to feel happy, but right now I just can't seem to do it. But I told you to feel happy. Yeah, I know. Don't you want to feel happy? Yeah, I want to feel happy. Then feel happy. The truth is, it's not a light switch that you can flip off and on. If you're going to feel happy, it's going to take some work. And it's going to be a part of learning to control those own feelings and such. It's a process we all have to go through. It's something I have to go through. And it's much harder on the spectrum to do something like this. But it can be done when you practice enough. But it's not going to be something you just command someone to do. So why I call it the tyranny of whiners is because people will say they feel bad based on something someone else did, and then use it to control them, which is exactly what I saw Rachel Harold Evans doing at this point. And I said, don't do it. Don't go down that path. Because, you know, if you're going to be walking across on eggshells every time, worried about making people feel bad constantly, you're not going to really do anything. On the same level, you're not going to be able to make everyone feel happy. A lot of you might not feel happy with some of the things I'm saying here because I'm going after beliefs that you hold near and dear to you, and you don't like that. Well, if you don't like it, you're just going to have to not like it, because I'm not changing that part. A lot of you also might feel really good about it. You might say, hey, I like hearing the show. I like hearing Some of that encourages my worldview. Well, okay, I'm glad you do, but at the same time, I wouldn't be changing anyway. Now, some of you might want to offer some criticism, say, well, you know, I think you shouldn't be saying things like this. Okay, but that's something I can look at. Or you could say, I think you should be saying things like this. Well, okay, that's something I can look at. But for each of you, I cannot claim direct responsibility. For instance, if this show went off the air because it offends some of you, well, some of you would be unhappy as a result because there are people who like this show. On the other hand, if I keep doing the show, which is certainly my plan, people who don't like this will be unhappy. I can't please everyone. So you know what the best system to do? Just do the right thing. And in the case of Chick-fil-A Day, what was being done was people coming out and exercising their free speech and saying, we support marriage. We want marriage to be between one man and one woman. You know what? They had every single right to do that. There were people out at Chick-fil-A's as well who were protesting, who were complaining about this. You know what? They had every single right to be doing that as well. Let them come and speak. And in fact, if we remember the stories, it was the Chick-fil-A workers themselves who brought out free drinks and food for these people who were protesting, which I thought was something just wonderful for them to be doing. But because someone does not like my stance on marriage, that doesn't mean I'm going to change my stance on marriage. What would make me change it? Evidence. That's the only thing that's going to dissuade me. You know what? I have no problems, in fact, being friends with someone who disagrees with me. I do have friends who disagree with me. I have friends who aren't Christians. I have no problem being friends with homosexuals, lesbians, or anything like that. Why? Because these are people still, regardless. There are people created in the image of God just as much as I am. There are people Jesus Christ loves and died for just as much as I am. Why not be friends with them? Why not celebrate with them? And in fact, if I truly believe that they're doing something that's wrong and harmful for them, the best thing I can do is be a friend for them so I can show a way that they can live. Not for my sake, but for their sake. Because, you know, a friend is a person who seeks the good of the other for the sake of the other. I don't want to go out there and preach the gospel to the person who's promiscuous or homosexual or anything like that just so they can convert to Christianity and drop their lifestyle and say, yep, mark me down for another one that I've brought to the Lord. That would be an entirely selfish motive for me to do it. I want to do it because it's good for these people to come to Christ. It's good for these people to behave in ways that is helpful to them. Those are good things that they should be doing. We should be celebrating them. And this is why I sometimes have a problem with what's called friendship evangelism. Because too often, we can seek to be friends with people and we're wanting to be friends with them just so we can send them, leave them to Jesus. I kind of feel like we're using people in that way. We're not really caring about them. I want to be friends with people just because they're good people. In the same way, I don't want to be friends with Christians friends with a person just because they're a Christian, because frankly, there are a lot of Christians out there I don't want to be friends with. I don't really like a lot of Christians that I meet. Whether I like someone or not, it doesn't depend on if they're a Christian. It depends on our personalities, how well we mesh together and such. And so, at the start of this, I'm going to say, let's drop this idea that just because something is judging or shameful, it's automatically something that shouldn't be done. In fact, if you're a true friend with someone, you're going to judge them. And if you have to sometimes, you will give them some shame because they've done wrong. A true friend is someone who's willing to look someone right in the eye and tell them what they need to say to give them that hard truth. Well, we've got about 20 minutes left in the show now, so at this point, I'm going to take another break, our final one, and we'll be back after this.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That, again, is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
Okay, now let's get back to this Planned Parenthood thing. Here's what else they say. Okay, now after the last thing I read, that's when you have the quote about the number of sexual partners and such. Here's what they do say is unhealthy. Some things that can be unhealthy include having sex before you're ready. You know, you kind of wonder at that point, when exactly would that be? I mean, is there some sort of maturity allowed for this? And why should there be anyway? I mean, this is just a behavior. You know, it's just sex. It's no big deal. Right? I mean, isn't that what we're told? Okay? Or having sex to try to seem impressive or cool. I mean, why? Seriously, what are they going to tell me is wrong about? Are they actually going to judge people who do that? Surely not. Are they going to try to shame people who are doing that? Surely not. You know, this is the kind of thing that you get when you get an idea of don't judge people. It always comes to don't judge people until they disagree with what I think is wrong, and then it's okay to judge them. You'll never meet someone, I certainly never have, who is a consistent moral relativist. I contend such people cannot exist. You got people who are wrong about every moral belief, but you cannot have anyone who's a consistent moral relativist, because they won't do anything. Having sex when you don't want to. Now, in some circumstances, I could agree. If we're talking about rape, that's definitely something immoral. Something shouldn't be done. On the other hand, there are a number of marriage counselors that will tell people on either side in the marriage, they say, you know, even if you're not really feeling things, every now and then, go alone with things and watch and see what happens. Because we don't all act based on our feelings. And you say, seek the good of the other person. Now, there are nuances and such to that, and that should be taken into consideration. But, I mean, if all we're talking about is rape, then yeah, we agree with that, okay? Having sex with people you don't like, trust, or care about. Okay. Now, I would say, yeah, that is and more, but for them, I'd want to say, why? What is unhealthy about it? What we're doing is asking if the behavior is unhealthy. Does it suddenly become unhealthy if you don't care about the person? I mean, does your body somehow change if you don't care about the person so the act becomes unhealthy? Does your mind somehow change? I mean, are we talking about a big deal or are we talking about no big deal? Which one is it? I mean, and having sex without using protection, like condoms and birth control. Okay, but if you're saying you have to use protection, why do you need some protection from something that's not unhealthy at all? Unless there is a health risk that you are trying to protect yourself from. And could it be that that risk is more than getting pregnant? Which is indeed in itself a risk. It's something that's really bizarre. I mean, why are you told to use this for multiple partners so often? Okay? Here's what they go on to say. If none of those behaviors sound like you, and if you feel satisfied with and confident about your sexual decisions, you have nothing to worry about. Okay, but first off, why do they get to set the standards of what behaviors are acceptable and what isn't? What is the moral basis for this kind of thing? So far, I haven't seen it given. It just seems like one person speaking from Sinai. But if that's his opinion, good for him or her, all right? But if it's not, then I need to see some sort of evidence. I need some argument why I should be thinking this way. And, you know, you can be confident about a moral decision and still be wrong. And what this person is saying is, hey, you know what, as long as you're confident, if you're going out there and you're sleeping with multiple people, you don't have a thing to worry about. You're not going to get any condition that is unhealthy. Well, I'm sorry, the CDC seems to disagree. Which one am I going to go with? Am I going to go with the CDC that actually does the statistics and provides the research in their work? Or am I going to go with Planned Parenthood? And you know, for all you skeptics out there who keeps talking, making a big deal about agendas, especially when it comes to the New Testament, you should really consider the agenda here. See? It says, even if someone calls you or your behavior promiscuous. And that's also a good reason to hold off on judging or gossiping about other people's sexual history, too. Why? I mean, why is it that Planned Parenthood gets to decide what it is to judge about? And why does it say it's a good idea to hold off on judging or gossiping about other people's sexual history? Who cares, as long as they're confident in their decisions, you know? And by the way, the source of this is someone named Alex at Planned Parenthood. You know, these are the people that are wanting to teach your own children, okay? Parents, please be listening to this. This is the kind of thing your children are getting. And some of you wonder, geez, Nick, why do you stress apologetics so much? Why? Because this is the kind of stuff out there that we're dealing with. These are the risks that are being taken. This is what has to be dealt with. Now, the Center of Disease Control instead has it differently. They say nearly 20 million new infections occur each year, half among the nation's youth. Yes, half. And in fact, a good number of them are HPV, 14.1 million, okay? Hepatitis B, 19,000, HIV, 41,400, syphilis, 55,400, HSV2, 776,000, gonorrhea, 820,000, trichomoniasis, 1,090,000, chlamydia, 2,860,000. And those are in young people. And some of them could be carrying multiple diseases, for all we know. Some of them can be treated early, but they say, however, too many of these infections go undetected because they often have no symptoms. Really, listen to that one. A young person can sleep with someone else, catch a disease, and not show any signs because they have no symptoms for a while. But even STIs that don't have symptoms, which means you have no idea that you're carrying these diseases, can have serious health consequences. Undiagnosed and untreated chlamydia, and that was 2,860,000 people having that one. Untreated chlamydia or gonorrhea, and gonorrhea is 820,000. Altogether, that's 3,680,000. For example, can put a woman at increased risk of chronic pelvic pain and life-threatening ectopic pregnancy, and can also increase a woman's chance of infertility. Women, how many of you want to risk that out there? How many of you want to risk that with just this random guy that you've met that you're going to have a one-night stand with? Really, how many of you want to risk a lifetime of pain for that one night? CDC estimates that HPV accounts for the majority of newly acquired STIs, while the vast majority, 9% of HPV infections, will go away on their own within 2 years and cause no harm. Some of these infections will take hold and potentially lead to serious disease, including cervical cancer. Right, how many of you would be willing to do something if you knew that in doing this action, you have a 10% chance of getting cancer someday? Now, I'm not saying that every time you sleep with someone, you got a 10% chance of getting cancer. But if you get HPV from someone, apparently you have a 10% chance of getting something that could lead to diseases, including cervical cancer. How many of you out there think it's worth it? Really? I mean, how many do? So, looking down here, And I'm still looking at this. And this is all from the CDC website. I mean, it's cdc.gov/std/sti-estimates-fact-sheet-feb-2013.pdf. If you want to look that up. Okay. Most sexually active men and women will get HPV at some point in their lives. This means that everyone is at risk for the potential outcomes of HPV, and any may benefit from prevention that the HPV vaccine provides. HPV vaccines are recommended for 11 or 12-year-old boys and girls. Wow. I mean, 11 or 12, I was playing Zelda more. Okay? Okay, I'm still doing that today. But back then, that was where my priorities were. And protect against some of the most common types of HPV that can lead to disease and cancer, including most cervical cancers. CDC recommends that all teen girls and women through age 26 get vaccinated, as well as all teen boys and men through age 21, and through age 26 for gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men. Okay, well, there you go, right there. We've confirmed that the CDC are homophobes and bigots because they're treating homosexual sex differently. Folks, this isn't a Christian organization saying this. This is the CDC saying this. HPV vaccines are most effective if they are provided before an individual ever has sex. You want to know another great effective treatment? Don't have sex until you're married. And after you do, stay with that one person that you're with. You know, you won't really have to worry about these kinds of things. HSV2, HPV, and HIV are lifelong infections that together account for nearly one quarter of all prevalent infections. And this is something that you have to consider. You're talking about serious infections. As additionally, nearly 18,000 people in the United States die with AIDS each year. And I suspect that's only going to go up. Now, we're talking about healthcare a lot in our country right now. Listen to this. STIs place a significant economic strain on the U.S. healthcare system. CDC conservatively estimates that the lifetime cost of treating 8 of the most common STIs contracted in just 1 year is $15.6 billion. You know a good way we could save money in this country economically? You want to know a really good way we could? Stop sleeping around. Yeah. If you do that, you can help save the economy. By practicing a Christian ethic of sex, you can save the economy. Okay. Abstaining from sex, reducing the number of sexual partners, and consistently and correctly using condoms are all effective STI prevention strategies. Safe, effective vaccines are also available to prevent HPV and other types of HPV that cause disease and cancer. And for all individuals who are sexually active, particularly young people, STI screening and prompt treatment, if infected, are critical protect a person's health and prevent transmission to others. Now, here are their recommendations. It says, be sure to talk to your healthcare provider about STI testing and which test may be right for you if you're sexually active. All adults and adolescents should be tested at least once for HIV. I'm going to tell you all right now, I have never once been tested. My wife never has been. You know why? You don't have to worry about it. Why? Because we've promised to be faithful to one another, and we saved ourselves from marriage. Annual chlamydia screening for all sexually active women aged 25 and under, as well as older women with risk factors such as new or multiple sex partners. Allie has never had to have that screening before. Never. Yearly gonorrhea screening for at-risk sexually active women, usually those with new or multiple sex partners, and women who live in communities with a high burden of disease. Again, now he's never had to have that. Syphilis, HIV, chlamydia, and hepatitis B screen for all pregnant women, and gonorrhea screen for at-risk pregnant women at the first prenatal visit. Protect the health of mothers and their infants. Guess what? Same thing said again. Trichomoniasis screening should be conducted at least annually for all HIV-infected women. Same thing applies. Now here's this. Screening at least once a year for syphilis, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and HIV for all sexually active gay men, bisexual men, and other men who have sex with men. MSM. MSM who have multiple anonymous partners should be screened more frequently for STIs, e.g. at 3 to 6 month intervals. In addition, MSM who have sex in conjunction with illicit drug use, particularly methamphetamine use, or whose sex partners participate in these activities should be screened more frequently. So, does this mean that the Centers for Disease Control are bigots and homophobes? Or, folks, are these just the facts? And this is why I do what I do. And when it comes to Planned Parenthood, let's just face it, they're a wicked organization. We are talking about what they are doing is killing live babies in the womb. Have no mercy on this. Have no tolerance for this position. Oh, tolerate the people who hold this position. Love them with the grace of God. But have no tolerance for this position. There are millions of people who will never get to celebrate their first birthday because of Planned Parenthood. Why don't you look around at your life and look at all that you enjoy? And yesterday Ali was talking to me and saying, do you ever sometimes find it hard to believe that you're married? So yeah, I do. And she said, yes, I do too. You know what, that great joy that we've got together, several people are never going to get to have that joy. Listening to your favorite song, having your first kiss, having a favorite meal, reading a good book, laughing at a joke, driving a car for the first time, getting your driver's license. Experiences like these, some people will never get to celebrate because they were never even given the chance. They were already determined at the start that they weren't going to get to live. And it wasn't because of any decision they made. It was because of a decision someone else made. It's evil, people. There's no other thing you can really say about it. This is wickedness. In fact, this is why when January comes, I'm devoting much of a show to pro-life apologetics. Like, it's not my specialty, okay? And I know people who it is their specialty, and God bless them. I'm so thankful they're out there. So they need to be doing their job. But groups like Planned Parenthood being out there, we have to be doing more. The reason abortion is out there today is because Christians dropped the ball big time in the marketplace of ideas. We stopped doing what we should be doing. You know, we can't change what happened in the past. But we can change what we're going to do with the future. And I encourage you all, please, make a change with what you're going to do in the future. Everything is at stake. Our young people are at stake. They are going out and they are having promiscuous behavior. And it is going to increase unless we do something about it. So I encourage you all, please do something about this. Stop the evil that we see going on in our society. All that we need, remember, for evil to prosper is for good men and women to do nothing. We're doing something right now, and we can keep doing something. Please continue. Well, that's going to be wrapping things up. We're going to be heading out here soon for a conference that's going to be here in Maryville. If you're in the area, please go to the Defending the Faith conference and look for the Deeper Waters table. Now, next week, please be listening. We've got Brent Sandy in here, and he's going to be talking about the book he co-wrote with John Walton, The Lost World of Scripture. I've been going with this book. It is a fascinating read. It is an awesome read, and I really encourage you to get it. Until next time, I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast, signing off. I'll see you next time.